operation. I sat in Morelli's chair and forced myself to think. Who is this fourth partner? A cop? A computer whiz? A professional crook? I looked at the red scarf. He wanted it hung from the second floor window. Why the second floor? Wouldn't it be easier to see it from the first floor if you were walking or driving past the house? I swiveled around and stared out the window. The houses on the opposite side of the street were all two-story, like Morelli's, easy to see into their bedroom windows from here. The convenient assumption would be that the partner lived in one of these houses, but Morelli had already gone door to door in his neighborhood and hadn't found anything odd. I called Morelli but got his voicemail. I called my mother and got my grandmother. She said my mother couldn't come to the phone because she'd taken a pill and fallen asleep after seeing me wrestling with the chicken on News at Noon. I called the office and was transferred to Connie's cell. She was at the courthouse trying to help resolve the Susan Stitch mess. My modus operandi when investigating is, if you have no ideas, eat something. It doesn't help to get ideas, but it passes the time. So I trekked downstairs and nuked a tray of mac and cheese. This got me to feeling very mellow because it's impossible to stay upset while eating mac and cheese. Here's a positive side, I told myself. You continue to make little inroads on the fourth partner's identity. If you can't find Dom and get your hands on the money, maybe you can find the fourth partner. He's kind of full of himself, and that confidence could be his undoing. I called Ranger. I want to get into Stanley Zero's apartment again, I told him.
That's a sealed crime scene, Ranger said.
And?
It would be safer if we went in at night.
I can wait.
I'll meet you in his apartment parking lot at 11.
I reached the school just as it was letting out. Zook ambled over to the car with his usual cluster of misfits and pulled the passenger side door open. He slouched into the seat, dropped his backpack on the floor between his feet, and looked over at me.
The kids at school are talking.
I gave the Sentra some gas and moved into the stream of traffic. What are they saying?
They're saying my mom cut out on me. Like, maybe she found the 9 million and took off with it.
They're wrong.
I sort of wouldn't blame her. That's a lot of money.
Your mom is okay. She's just not accessible right now.
What's that mean?
I can't tell you, but we're trying to work it all out. He pushed his backpack around with a foot that seemed way too big for his slim frame. He was like a puppy that hadn't grown up to his feet yet.
I'm not some dumb little kid, he said. I deserve to know what's going on with my mom.
I turned onto Hamilton and slid a sideways glance at him. He wasn't dumb, and he wasn't a little kid. He was a big kid. And he had a point. He needed to know what was going on with his mom. You're right, I said. You deserve to know. But you can't tell anyone. No one at school, not Mooner, not Gary, no one. He nodded his head. 3 men robbed the bank with your Uncle Dom. 2 are dead, and your uncle is in hiding. The fourth partner has your mom and is holding her for ransom. He wants the $9 million. Problem is, we don't have it, and we don't know where it's located. The police are involved, and we're making progress at getting your mom back, but you have to be patient.
That is so sucky, he said.
You're right, I said on a sigh. It is totally sucky. Mooner and Gary were waiting on Morelli's front steps when I pulled to the curb with Zook. They were dressed in army fatigues, and they stood and saluted when I parked the car. Zook and I burst out laughing. I know they're goofy, I said to Zook, but I like them. They're in the moment. I unlocked Morelli's front door, and Bob rushed out and ran around in circles. He did some yelping and grunting, and then he hunched and pooped out my underwear.
Whoa, Mooner said. Victoria's Secret colonic, dude. Far out.
Bob ran back into the house the instant he was done, and we all followed. Eventually, I'd come out in rubber gloves and contamination suit and scoop up the deposit, but for now, I was walking away from it. Where did you get the clothes? I asked Mooner.
Army surplus. We got some for the Zookster, too.
We changed the patches, Gary said. We made them say homegrown security.
I got everyone settled in the living room with chips and pretzels and sodas. I phoned for pizza. I asked about Zook's homework. How bizarre was this? It was like running a daycare facility. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? I mean, who am I?
I was raised to have traditional values, but I screwed up on my first marriage big time. I took an odd job, and now I love two men. One is definite husband and father material. The other, I don't know what to think of the other. And now here I was doing my mother cat impersonation. The doorbell rang, and I went to answer it. I opened the door and didn't bother to hold back the grimace. It was Brenda and her film crew.
"How about it?" she said. "Have you thought of anything?"
"No."
"Make something up. You've got an imagination, right? This is the news. It doesn't have to be real."
"I thought that was the whole purpose of the news, to report real stuff."
"Oh, please. You don't actually believe that crap. You think we could get ratings with real stuff? The news people make up entire wars. Listen, all you have to do is find something sexy to say about the money, like, 'Tall, dark, and handsome Morelli was taking a nap, and he woke up and thought he heard a noise in the yard, so he rushed out naked and tackled some guy who was digging with a shovel, and Morelli saw a couple $100 bills sticking out of the ground.'"
Brenda smiled.
"See? It's easy."
"I'd like to help you, but I don't think I could pull that off."
"Of course you can. Look at me. I can do it, and I'm not that good. I'm just motivated. I've got a $3 million house in Brentwood with a mortgage big enough to choke a horse."
She looked at the guys on the couch.
"Is that Gary?"
Gary waved at her.
"I'm lurking."
"No shit," she said. "What's with the uniform? Did you join the army?"
"Homegrown security," Gary said. "I'm a gunnery officer."
"Great," Brenda said. "Perfect. A gunnery officer. That makes me feel real safe."
"Yeah, but you still have to watch out for the pizza," Gary said.
Brenda's face brightened.
"Maybe I could do a feature on stalkers. We could film you stalking me," she said to Gary.
"I appreciate the offer, but no thanks," Gary said. "I haven't got time to stalk right now. I promised the guys I'd lurk, and I'm on standby with Homegrown."
Brenda narrowed her eyes at Mooner.
"You stole my stalker."
"No way. The Mooner doesn't steal. He, like, borrows sometimes, but he's got a code. He's protecting his oneness."
"Oneness my ass," Brenda said. "I could own you like a cheap suit."
"Whoa," Mooner said. "Have you been talking to the wood elves?"
The sound man was standing behind Brenda.
"If we don't get filmed to the studio soon, we'll miss our spot."
"I'm not missing my spot," Brenda said, turning from me and storming off the porch.
I closed the door and peeked out the living room window at her. She was standing over Bob's poo while the cameraman zoomed in for a closer look.
"And here we have a suspicious substance on Joe Morelli's front lawn," Brenda said into her mic. "It would appear that the dog in this household has been fed a thong. Clearly a case for investigation by..."
She looked over at the sound man.
"Who investigates this shit?"
Chapter 20. Lula was on my cell phone.
"I'm 2 minutes away," she said. "Be out front. I'm in a consultation for my wedding gown, and I need an opinion. You gotta go back to the bride's store with me."
"Okay, but I can't stay away too long. I don't like leaving Zook on his own."
"Don't he have Homegrown security with him?"
"Yeah, that's part of the problem." I grabbed my purse, told everyone I'd be back soon, and I was on my cell if an emergency arose, and I ran out of the house. The Firebird careened around the corner and slid to a stop in front of me. Lula was behind the wheel in a silky bathrobe.
"I got an hour appointment with these bitches," she said, "and the clock's ticking."
"You're in a bathrobe."
"It took less time than getting back in my clothes."
I fastened my seatbelt, and we rocketed away. "I thought you were having second thoughts about marrying an alcoholic."
"Yeah, but I had this appointment, and I didn't want to lose it. I might have to wait weeks to get another appointment. I mean, even if I don't marry Tank, chances are good I'll marry someone else someday. Might as well get the gown, I figure."
"You might want to rethink that plan."
"Yeah, it's insane, right? It's that I have momentum.
You see what I'm saying?
It's all in motion, and it don't stop. Turns out, that's how it is with weddings. You just keep getting in deeper and deeper until you want to throw up."
Lula hooked a left, cut across traffic, and zipped into the small parking lot that attached to the bridal salon. We got out and hurried into the showroom.
"You sit down, and I'll put the gown on," Lula said.
I was halfway through a magazine when she rustled out of the dressing room. The gown was brilliant white satin and fit like skin from Lula's ankles to her armpits. It was strapless and had a bustle in the back over her ass and a 12-foot train that stretched out behind her. We like this one because it's so slimming, the saleswoman said. We think it hugs her curves and is very flattering. She's a lucky lady that we had her size in stock.
All it needs is some of them crystal beads to make it sparkle, Lula said. They said they could sew them on.
The gown was slimming because it was two sizes too small and squished in all Lula's fat and pushed it up until there was no more gown. She was spilling out of the top in rolls of Lula. She had cleavage everywhere, front, back, side. It's pretty, I said, but there seems to be a lot of you oozing over the top. Maybe you should go up a size.
They don't got this in a bigger size, Lula said. And anyway, I don't want it too big on account of I'm planning to lose some weight.
I heard something pop and fly off the back of the dress, and the zipper burst open.
Huh, Lula said. This here seems to be shoddy workmanship.
10 minutes later, Lula dropped me at Morelli's.
Boy, Lula said, I dodged that bullet. Those people don't know how to sew.
You might consider getting married in a dress instead of a gown, I said. It wouldn't even have to be white.
And it could be more representative of my outgoing personality, Lula said. It could be animal print. You know how I'm partial to animal print.
And it would be practical because you could wear it even if you didn't get married.
I'm psyched, Lula said. I'm going to the mall. You want to come?
No, Morelli should be getting off his shift right about now, and I need to talk to him. I was in the kitchen eating pizza when Morelli rolled in. He helped himself to a piece from the box and went to the refrigerator in search of beer.
My refrigerator is filled with potatoes, he said,
door open, face bathed in refrigerator light.
They're everywhere. I've got potatoes in the egg holder.
Ammo, I think the beer is behind the half-baked. He moved some potatoes around and grunted when he found the beer.
Zook's a terrific kid, but I feel displaced. Bad enough Mooner is always here. Now we've got Gary. Once I got up in the middle of the night to get water, and I swear I saw him sitting in a lawn chair in front of my garage.
Imagine that, I said. How odd.
Have you heard from the partner?
No, the ball's in our court. Morelli took a second piece of pizza.
This is bad. Either someone is leaking information, or the guy is inside.
Or maybe he's some genius computer geek that can tap into phones and computers. Morelli shook his head.
That only happens in the movies. This guy knew about the van and the money. I didn't tell anyone, and Spanner swears he didn't tell anyone. I know the Fed who's running the show, and I can't see him telling anyone.
What about the sack of shit?
Larry Skid? He could leak. And there were some other people working details. Looking at it in retrospect, we should have played it tighter, but there's always all this chain of command crap.
I assume the department is investigating.
Yes, but there's not much to go on. Truth is, some of this op went through the bureaucracy. The van needed to be requisitioned, the storage facility had to be cleared, yada yada.
I checked to make sure Zook wasn't listening, and I lowered my voice. He said he would cut Loretta's hand off at noon tomorrow if he doesn't have the money.
He's sick, Morelli said. He's caught up in the drama. If he was thinking sanely, he'd back off and wait. There's no way he's going to drive away with $9 million. It was a good plan when they executed it 10 years ago, but it's not a good plan now that the police are involved.
I suppose he figures he can stay ahead of the game if he can force me to locate the money and drive the van to him without telling anyone. Morelli cut his eyes to me.
You wouldn't do that, would you?
Of course not, I said. And we both knew I would. Problem was, I had the key, but I didn't know what to do with it, and I had no way to reach Dom. I suspected Dom and the fourth partner had the same dilemma. Dom had always talked to Zero and Gritelli.
I can practically see the wheels turning in your head, Morelli said. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking this is pathetic. There's no communication between the major players here. Dom and I have identical goals right now, but we can't get anything done because I can't get in touch with him.
Connie couldn't pull up a cell number?
No, nothing for Dom. And the partner has me calling him on Zero's phone. I had Connie run it.
Let's go obvious, Morelli said. We think Dom watches the house, so make a sign and hang it in the living room window. Have key, call me.
I ran upstairs to Morelli's office and used black magic marker on a piece of computer paper. I brought the sign downstairs and taped it to the window. We only have a couple hours of daylight where he can read it, I said to Morelli.
No problem.
I'll hook up a spot.
We moved Zook and Mooner and Gary into the dining room, and Morelli and Bob and I sat in front of the television waiting for the call. At 10 o'clock, I got a call, but it was from the wrong person.
You must be kidding, he said.
It was a fourth partner.
What?
He sighed into the phone.
You don't have any way of getting in touch with this idiot either, do you?
You mean Dom? No.
You better hope he sees your sign, because I'm running out of patience.
And he disconnected. That was the fourth partner, I said to Morelli. He saw the sign. At 10:30, I had a problem. I didn't know how to get out of the house to meet Ranger without Morelli going postal. Take the coward's way out, I thought. Go out the bathroom window and deal with Morelli when you get home. I didn't want anyone to think I was kidnapped, so I wrote a message on the toilet lid with my eyeliner pencil. Be back soon, don't worry. I climbed out the window onto the small overhang that shelters the back stoop. Morelli's house is almost identical to my parents' house, and this was the route I'd used all through high school to sneak out with my friends. I rolled off the edge of the roof and lowered myself down. I felt hands at my waist, and I got an assist from Morelli.
Damn it, I said to him. How did you know?
I have the windows attached to the new alarm system. It dings when you open them. What are you doing?
I'm meeting Ranger, and you don't want any more information than that.
Wrong.
He glanced at his garage.
It looks like the light is on.
Gary has his camper parked in there.
Morelli was silent for a couple beats.
Notice I'm not yelling, he said to me.
Yeah, but I think the roots of your hair are smoking.
How long has Gary been squatting in my garage?
A couple days.
Morelli opened the back door for me.
Get in the house.
Fine with me. My car was parked out front. Now I didn't have to walk halfway around the block.
I won't be long, I told Morelli, wasting no time getting through the kitchen and dining room.
Maybe an hour.
Morelli was close behind me.
Is this about Loretta?
Yep.
I'm going with you.
That's not a good idea.
Why not?
You don't want to know, I told him.
And Ranger is in on this?
He's not in on it. I asked him to help me. He has skills I lack.
Such as?
He's good with locks.
You're right. I don't want to know. But if anything happens to you, I'll go after Ranger, and it won't be pretty.
Nothing's gonna happen.
Probably. I ran to my car and took off. The fourth partner saw the sign, and that meant he was watching the house. I didn't want to be followed, so I wound around in the burg looking for headlights behind me. When I felt absolutely safe, I cut across town to Route 1 and headed for Stanley Zero's apartment complex. Ranger was already there when I pulled into the lot. He was in his black Porsche Turbo watching the building. I parked next to him, and he got out. He was wearing black jeans and t-shirt and a black windbreaker, nothing with the rangeman insignia. He looked at my ghoulish complexion and smiled.
Long story, I said.
I know the story. I'm just sorry I missed seeing you before you faded.
We walked to the entrance, and when we got to the door, he draped an arm across my shoulders. We were a couple, home from date night. When Ranger got close to me like this, I could smell his Bulgari shower gel. I've used the same gel, and the scent is fleeting on me. It lingers on Ranger. Zero's apartment was sealed with yellow crime scene tape. A do-not-enter notice was tacked to the door. Ranger peeled the tape back, used a pick on the lock, and in seconds, we were inside. Nothing keeps Ranger out when he wants to get in. I've seen him open a door when a slide bolt was thrown. It's borderline eerie. We pulled on disposable gloves and methodically moved through the apartment. There were smudges where the crime lab had searched for prints, and marks on the carpet where the body had fallen. I'm looking for something that might give me the identity of Dominic Rizzi's fourth partner, I told Ranger.
Either the killer swept the apartment, or else the crime lab did an unusually thorough evidence collection, Ranger said. I'm not finding anything. No cell phone, no computer, no address book.
I had a few minutes to look around after I discovered the body, and I don't remember seeing a computer or phone. I went through all his pockets, with the exception of the clothes he was wearing. I couldn't bring myself to touch the body.
He was dressed?
In jeans and a shirt. His boots were beside the bed.
They're still there, Ranger said.
He walked into the bedroom and picked up one of the boots.
I know it's a cliché, but people really do hide things in their shoes.
He removed the padded insert and found a scrap of paper with a phone number on it.
Damn, I said, you're good.
Ranger smiled.
That's what they tell me. Do you recognize the number?
No, but it's local. Ranger called the control room and gave them the number. 2 minutes later, the answer came back. The number belonged to Alma Rizzi. So Dom was using his mother's cell phone, and Zero hadn't wanted to share that information with his partner. He didn't trust himself to remember the number, so he hid it in his shoe. This was quite the group of guys. I dialed the number, but there was no answer.
Nothing in the other boot, Ranger said. I think we've done as much as we can here.
We let ourselves out, took the stairs, crossed the small lobby, and walked to our cars.
Not much of a date, Ranger said.
Not true. I got a phone number. He kissed me on the cheek.
You could have gotten more than a phone number.
I'll take a rain check. Morelli remoted the television off when I walked into the house. He stood and stretched.
Well?
Someone picked Zero's apartment clean.
You didn't find anything?
No. Our eyes held for a moment, and he didn't ask anything more, and I didn't tell. I trusted Morelli, but he was a cop, after all, and the cops didn't have a good track record on this operation. It was 4 in the morning, and I was wide awake, trying not to thrash around and disturb Morelli. I couldn't stop thinking about the fourth partner. He was out there, moving through his day as a normal person. This guy, who could kill his friends and mutilate a mother. He did his mundane job and talked sports scores while he drank coffee with his friends. And he was watching Morelli's house and monitoring police action. How was he doing that? When the bedside clock hit 5:30, I got dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and sneakers. I went downstairs, made coffee, and dialed Dom. Still no answer. I could hear Morelli moving around upstairs. It was a work day. I was pacing when he came into the kitchen.
What's a special occasion? He asked. You're never up this early.
I couldn't sleep. Loretta will lose her hand today if I don't figure this out.
It's not your fault.
I know that. I just don't want it to happen.
Me either. I'm still on the gang killings, but Spanner's keeping me in the loop. The feds are nuts that the op got blown. They're on everyone's ass.
You went door to door, right? You talked to all your neighbors?
Everyone on the street. I covered 3 blocks.
He poured coffee into a travel mug and capped it.
I have an early meeting. I'll grab a bagel on the way in.
He kissed me on the top of my head.
I have to go. Be careful. This guy is a real crazy. Don't piss him off. I'll try to keep in touch.
I fed Bob and hooked him to his leash. Time for a walk, I told him. I knew we were missing something, and walking Bob would give me a chance to look around. The fourth partner was close. He saw the sign intended for Dom. He saw the scarf. And he was the one who broke into Morelli's house and got the key. He knew when Morelli and I left the house to take Grandma home. I walked 2 blocks in each direction several times. The guy was so close I could practically smell him, but I couldn't put my finger on him. Zook was eating breakfast when I returned. He looked up expectantly. Hang in there, I told him.
She's okay, isn't she?
Yes.
Alive is okay, right? Worse things in life than missing a toe or two.
I tried to give him a reassuring smile, but I'm not sure I totally pulled it off. I drove Zook to school and rode around Morelli's block. I cruised by his house and looked up at the second floor windows. They were visible from the street, but I was having a hard time thinking this guy was constantly driving by. He was squirreled away somewhere, and he could see the house. I kept a gym bag in the back. It held bounty hunter stuff. Cuffs, shackles, stun gun, cheese doodles, flashlight, and binoculars. I grabbed the binoculars out of the bag and brought them into the house. I ran up the stairs and trained the glasses on the houses across the street. I looked in all the windows. I looked at the front yards and the cars parked in front of the houses. I looked over the roofs to see if line of sight carried to any houses on the next block. I put the binoculars down and pressed my fingers to my eyeballs.
Think, Stephanie, what are you missing? There has to be something.
I raised the binoculars again and ran them across the housetops.
And there it was, a camera.
It was positioned on the roof directly across from Morelli.
I don't know how I missed it.
I suppose I just wasn't looking for it before. I called Ranger on my cell.
I need some technical information, I said to him. Can you mount a camera somewhere, like on a roof, and access it from somewhere else? I mean, do you need wires and things?
No, you can transmit wireless. If you're going a distance, you need relays, or you can bounce it off a satellite.
Suppose you want to run it all day, day after day. You'd need a power source, right?
Yes. If it was on a roof, you could tie into the house's electric. It would be easy if the house had a dish.
I used the phone in Morelli's office to call him.
What? He whispered into his phone. I've got it.
I'm in a meeting, he said. Is this important?
Didn't you hear me? I've got it. I know how the fourth partner saw the scarf and the sign, and I know how he saw us leave the house to take Grandma home. There's a camera on the roof of the house across from you.
Are you sure?
I'm looking at it through binoculars. Do you know the people who live across from you? Would they put a camera on their roof?
Mr. and Mrs. Geary live across from me. They're nice, but they're about 110. I can't imagine why they'd have a camera on their roof. I'm stuck in this meeting, but I'll send Spanner over with a tech.
I was cracking my knuckles now because in a couple hours Loretta would lose her hand. I was calling Alma Rizzi's phone every 15 minutes, and no one was answering. The sign was in Morelli's window. Nothing happening with that. The red scarf was on Morelli's desk. I had no reason to hang it in the window. I looked up, and Mooner was in the doorway.
The door was unlocked, so I figured you were open for business, Mooner said.
I had my hand over my heart. You took me by surprise. Next time, yell when you come into the house.
I was projecting my aura, but you might have been too distracted to catch it. Probably you were struggling with the feng shui in this room. Major bummer on that one.
He looked across the hall.
Where's Zucamundo?
School.
Again?
5 days a week.
Whoa, he must be serious about it.
Have you had breakfast?
No, we were all out of Cap'n Crunch. I had my standard, you know. I was hoping the dude had some.
We trekked downstairs. I pawed through Morelli's cupboard, found a half-empty box of Cap'n Crunch, and gave it to Mooner. I brewed a new pot of coffee and turned to see Gary at the back door. I opened the door and Gary came in. How long have you been standing there? I asked him.
I just got here. I had a dream you were making coffee.
You dreamed correct, I told him. Help yourself. I went to the living room and looked out the window, and Mooner and Gary followed me.
What are we looking at? Mooner wanted to know.
I'm waiting for one of Morelli's partners to show up.
Cool,
Mooner said, sharing the box of crunch with Gary. Spanner finally arrived in a blue Fairlane.
Bummer, Mooner said. No lights.
He's not a uniform, I told Mooner. I have to talk to him. You stay here.
Homegrown security on the job, Mooner said. You can count on Gary and me.
If you knew where to look, you could see the camera from the street. I positioned Spanner as far back as he could go in Morelli's small yard and handed him my binoculars.
I see it, Spanner said. It looks like a camera, all right.
We walked across the street and Spanner knocked on the Geary's front door. The door was answered by a little old man still in his pajamas. Spanner introduced himself and asked about the camera.
You have a camera on your roof, Spanner said.
What?
Mr. Geary asked.
A camera.
Where?
On your roof.
Mr. Geary looked confused.
Where's the camera?
I'd like permission to take a look at it, Spanner said.
What do you want to look at?
Mr. Geary asked.
The camera.
I looked at my watch. This could take a while. Spanner had it figured out, too. He jumped in with the bottom line.
Okay, thanks, Spanner said to Geary. Appreciate you letting us take a look at the camera. I'm gonna send a tech up there.
Sure,
Mr. Geary said.
Always happy to help the police.
I need to run, Spanner said to me. I'm gonna send someone to get the camera. In the meantime, you might want to close your curtains when you get undressed.
Getting caught undressing was the least of my problems. I was counting down to dismemberment. I watched Spanner drive away, and I spotted the news van parked at the end of the block. Brenda was hovering. I couldn't blame her. I understood her problem, and I might have done the same thing. She was trying to make a job for herself. Still, it was annoying. I paced in the living room, waiting for the tech to come get the camera. To pass the time, I called Almarizzi's cell phone. And Dom picked up.
What?
He said. Dom?
Who's this?
It's Stephanie. Don't hang up. I have to talk to you about Loretta.
What about her?
Your partner has amputated two of her toes and sent them here. If I don't give him the garage location by noon, he's going to cut her hand off. I could hear Dom suck in some breath.
Jesus,
he said. Morelli isn't involved in this, I told Dom. It's just me negotiating with your partner, and he's desperate. He wants the money.
I don't even care about the money anymore,
Dom said.
I just want this over, and I want to be the one to talk to him. I want to hear his voice. I want to make sure he isn't going to hurt Loretta anymore.
I didn't trust Dom to keep it together. He wasn't exactly smart, and he wasn't emotionally stable. We can call him together, I said. I can put him on speakerphone so you can listen, but please let me do the talking. I don't want this screwed up.
Yeah, you're right. I'd probably screw it up. I want to kill the bastard. I want to rip his eyes out. I want to cut his balls off and shove them down his throat.
Probably you should do the anger management course that was offered to you, I said to Dom.
Fuck that. That shit is for pussies. Give me 10 minutes. I gotta get a car.
I disconnected Dom and saw a crime scene van park in front of the Geary's house. The tech offloaded a folding ladder, set it against the house, and climbed to the roof. You guys stay here, I told Mooner and Gary. I want to talk to the tech. I waited on the sidewalk while the tech unbolted the camera and put it in a large evidence bag. He climbed down and walked the camera to the van. I had his age at late 30s to early 40s. He was average height and build. He had brown hair cut short, ears that would lift him off the ground if they caught enough wind, and his eyes were hidden behind Oakley's. He was wearing a wrinkled, short-sleeved, collared knit shirt and khakis that were bagged out and creased at the crotch. I was guessing he had no wife, and his mother was either dead or lived out of state. What happens to the camera now? I asked him.
We'll take it to the shop and have a look at it.
I felt a flash of heat pass through my entire body, and my heart jumped in my chest. Major adrenaline rush. It was the voice. I looked down at his shoes. Jackpot. I was afraid to talk. I didn't trust my voice. I smiled and nodded. Okay, then, I managed to say. I backed away and walked stiff-legged across the street. I slipped into Morelli's house and closed and locked the door. I tried to call Morelli on my cell, but my hand was shaking so bad I couldn't get the numbers right. I held my breath and tried again.
Morelli here, he said.
It's the crime lab tech, I told him. He's across the street. He just took the camera down, and I recognized his voice and the shoes. He's the fourth partner.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. Mostly.
I'm on my way. Where are you?
In your house.
Stay there. Lock the doors. You know where I keep my extra gun?
Yes.
Get it.
What's going on? Mooner wanted to know.
I think the crime lab tech might be Dom's fourth partner. Stay in the house. Morelli is on his way home.
I ran upstairs, got Morelli's gun, and returned to the living room. Mooner was standing guard at a window with his potato bazooka. Gary was behind him with a basket of potatoes.
We're ready to defend the house, Mooner said.
Okay, I said, but don't fire anything off unless I tell you to.
Mooner and Gary saluted. I shoved Morelli's gun into the waistband of my jeans at the small of my back, and I stood beside Mooner and looked out the window. The gun was cold and hard and uncomfortable. I popped the snap on my jeans, but it didn't help a lot. I removed the gun and shoved it under a couch cushion for safekeeping. It was a semi-automatic Glock, and I didn't actually know how to use it anyway. The crime lab tech stowed the ladder and was about to drive off when Dom rolled to a stop in front of Morelli's house. Dom got out and nodded at the tech. The tech got out of his van and crossed to Dom.
Crap. I didn't know what to do. I had no idea what was being said.
I didn't want to rush out and blunder into a perfectly benign conversation, but I also didn't want Dom to disappear forever.
Should we shoot them? Mooner asked.
No.
The tech was talking, and Dom was nodding in agreement. Dom gave a quick glance to Morelli's house, took his phone out of his pocket, and punched a number in. Seconds later, my phone rang.
I need the keys, Dom said.
That's not a good idea.
It is a good idea.
At least try to stall him so I can set something up.
For Christ's sake, Dom said. Just bring me the keys. He gets the van with the money, and I get Loretta.
Okay, I'll send the keys out, but I'm staying here.
Whatever,
Dom said. If I was the partner, I'd want a hostage to ensure my escape. And I'd make a better hostage than Loretta, since the lack of toes had to slow her down. I supposed he could take Dom, but I wasn't sure anyone would care. I retrieved the keys from my purse, opened the front door, and pitched the keys into the street. Dom scuttled over and scooped them up, and both men got into the Tex van and drove off. I saw the van turn right at the corner, and I sprinted to my car. Mooner and Gary ran with me and jumped into the back seat. Mooner still had his bazooka, and Gary had his basket of potatoes. I got to the corner and looked right. They were two blocks in front of me. Keep your eyes on the van, I told Mooner and Gary. I don't want to lose them, but I can't get too close. The van turned left into the burg. This was the logical place for Dom to hide the money. Dom had friends there, and there were lots of unused garages. I looked in my rearview mirror. Brenda's film crew was a car length away. Could it get any worse? I followed the tech van as it wove through the burg. It turned into an alley, and I hesitated. I would be clearly visible if I followed. I took a chance and drove down a street running parallel. I waited at the cross street, but the van didn't emerge. 5 minutes passed, and still no van. I parked in front of a small corner deli, and we all got out. Brenda and the film crew did the same. Mooner had his potato gun, and Gary had his basket of potatoes, and Stephanie had nothing since the Glock was still under the couch cushion. I told everyone to stay where they were, out of sight, and not to go into the alley. There were garages on both sides. Hard to tell from where I stood, but I was guessing 12 to 16 garages in all. The older garages, originally built with the row houses, were singles. The newer garages were two-car. I walked the alley looking for open garage doors, listening at closed doors. Halfway down the alley, I heard an engine catch. A door to a two-car garage rolled up, and a maroon Econoline with Pennsylvania plates jumped out of the garage and turned in my direction. The tech was driving. No sign of Dom. The Econoline roared at me, and I dove between garages to avoid getting hit. He missed me by inches and continued to race down the alley. It's him, I yelled. It's the fourth partner.
No problemo, Mooner said. Raw russet, he told Gary.
And foomph, direct hit to the windshield. The van swerved, took out a parked car, ran into the back of the deli, and exploded. $9 million in hundreds shot into the air and floated down, plus the contents of the deli's frozen food locker.
Sweet, Mooner said.
Are you filming? Brenda yelled to her cameraman. It's raining money and popsicles.
And in that instant, Brenda got hit with a family-size frozen pizza. Pepperoni, black olives. It whacked her in the face and knocked her to her knees.
Ulk,
she said. Her eyes rolled into the back of her head, and she went face down. The cameraman grabbed her feet, and the sound man grabbed her under the armpits, and they carried her back to the news truck. The maroon Econoline was a fireball. Sirens were screaming in the distance. People were running from neighboring houses, scarfing up the money and frozen fish sticks and disappearing back into their homes. Mooner was running everywhere, stuffing $100 bills into his pants and his shirt. I looked down the alley and saw Dom jogging my way. Are you okay? I asked him.
I'm better than okay. I'm fucking fabulous. The son of a bitch blew himself up.
You were in the garage a long time.
The battery was dead, Dom said. We had to give it a jump start.
I thought the key disabled the bomb. Why did it explode? Dom was grinning.
I don't know. I'm guessing it just went off when the van rammed into the deli. The asshole should have moved the boxes of money to a different car before he took off, but he was in a rush to get away. Tell you the truth, I was practically crapping in my pants giving the van a jump. Alan was the one who rigged the bomb, and between you and me, Alan wasn't the sharpest tack on the board.
Did you find out about Loretta?
She's in the basement of the lab guy's house. He lives two blocks from Morelli. He said she's okay.
I jogged back to the deli with Dom and stuffed him into my car. Brenda was on her feet with a big Band-Aid across her nose and tissue stuffed up her nostrils, and she was interviewing Mooner. Gary was rocked back on his heels, smiling. His prophecy had come true. The only thing left was the business about Brenda sitting on a toilet on Route 1, and I was hoping I wouldn't be around for that one. I was moving the car so the fire trucks could get better access, and saw Morelli fly in with his roof light flashing. I pulled alongside him.
"We're all okay," I said. "The fourth partner was in the van with the money. It looks like a lot of the money survived. I don't think the lab tech made it."
"What about Loretta?"
"The lab tech told Dom she's locked away in his basement."
"I've got his address," Morelli said. "Spanner fed me the information on my way over. The tech's name is Steve Fowler, and besides being a crime scene tech, he also did some moonlighting as security at the bank 10 years ago.
I followed Morelli, and we wound through the burg and took a left into Morelli's neighborhood. He parked in front of a row house that looked like all the other row houses on the street. 2 stories, small front yard. Neat, but unexceptional. No indication that a killer lived inside. We all piled out of our cars and went to the door. We all looked a little grim. We weren't sure what we'd find. Amputation isn't pretty. And for that matter, we weren't convinced Loretta was still alive. Morelli tried the door, locked, of course. He moved to a window, also locked. He put his elbow to it, and it shattered. He cleared some glass away, opened the window, and went in. He opened the door for us and told everyone to stay in the foyer. He drew his gun and moved to the cellar door. Dom and I were silent, gnawing on our lower lips, barely breathing. A couple minutes passed, and there were footsteps on the cellar stairs, and next thing, Loretta was standing there in front of us. She was pale and shaking, and her hair was snarled. She was crying and laughing, borderline hysteria. We all stared at her feet and hands. No big bandages, no sign of amputation.
"You have all your toes," I said to her.
She looked down at herself.
"Yeah," she said. "What do you mean?"
"He said he chopped off 2 toes. I saw them."
"Not mine," Loretta said.
I looked at Morelli, and Morelli shrugged. He hadn't a clue who belonged to the toes. It was 6 o'clock, and we were all in front of the television eating meatball subs, tuned in to the news. Mooner, Gary, Zook, Loretta, Dom, Morelli, Bob, and me. Lula had declined in favor of a night with her big honeypot. The party was thrown by Mooner with money he'd collected when the Econoline exploded. Mooner'd given $20,000 to Loretta and Zook, $10,000 to the animal shelter so they could offer free cat spaying, and he'd bought a very used mellow yellow Corvette with the remaining money. True, the money was slightly illegal, but hell, this was Mooner we were talking about. Almost everything he did was slightly illegal. Brenda's theme song came up, and we all sat forward. Brenda popped onto the screen wearing a low scoop-neck sweater and a tiny skirt. She had 2 black eyes and a Band-Aid on her nose.
"Here I am, with an exclusive on the $9 million mystery conclusion," Brenda said. "You'll have to excuse my appearance as I was in a freak pizza accident."
There was film of the maroon Econoline going out of control, crashing into the deli and exploding. And then Brenda was on film with tissues up her nose.
"And here we have an interview with the man who took down the vicious criminal responsible for murder, mayhem, and kidnapping."
The camera panned to Mooner, and everyone in Morelli's living room yelled and whistled.
"Tell us exactly how you did it,"
Brenda said, pointing the mic at Mooner.
"It was with my potato rocket," Mooner said, looking into the camera. "And my munitions man, Gary, deserves some credit for giving me exactly the right potato."
The camera returned to Brenda.
"There you have it," she said. "Another exclusive from Brenda. And sadly for you, but happily for me, this is my last piece of news on this station. I'm going national with my own reality show, and I'm co-hosting the show with my very own stalker and psychic, Gary."
There was more whistling and cheering on our part, and Gary took a bow. Dom stood and raised a bottle of beer.
"Now that all this is over and Loretta's safe, I want to say, let bygones be bygones. And I still think Morelli's a piece of shit for getting Loretta pregnant and walking away, but I'm not going to kill him like I planned."
Loretta looked up at Dom.
"What the heck are you talking about? Morelli isn't Mario's father. Morelli was a jerk. I wouldn't have anything to do with him."
Then who's the father?
Dom wanted to know.
It was Lenny Garvis. I got pregnant the night before he died. I didn't want to make a big deal about it. Mario always knew, but I didn't tell anyone else.
Lenny Garvis? He was in Morelli's class, 2 years ahead of me and mentally a few years behind. I remembered his death. The idiot choked on a peanut butter and banana sandwich. I mean, how could you possibly choke on a peanut butter sandwich? Dom wasn't convinced.
I saw you in the garage with Morelli.
That wasn't me, Loretta said. That was Jenny Ragucci. She was such a slut.
Morelli smiled.
It could have been Jenny Ragucci. That makes much more sense. I had good luck with sluts.
I looked over at him.
All in the past, Morelli said. I'm a cupcake man now.
Whoa, dude, Mooner said.
That's so, like, cosmic.
I'm talking with Janet Ivanovich now. I'm in New York recording Fearless 14, Janet's latest book in the Stephanie Plum series. Hi, Janet.
Hi there.
Fearless 14 is fantastic. 14 books with these characters. I think that's brave. How's it been going?
It's going great. You know, in some ways, it almost gets easier. I don't know. I have a lot of momentum going for it. And, you know, I love going back into that world of Plum all the time.
That's interesting because I was going to ask how you keep the characters so fresh. But, of course, if you feel you know them better, like you know your own family, I suppose that's that makes it easier.
Yeah, and there's always something different to be learned about them. You know, they grow just a little bit or you find out something different about them. And I have all of these secondary characters, you know, that I bring in that makes it interesting for me. Like this time, one of the interesting things was the relationship with Ranger. Because Ranger, you know, is a little humanized in this book. I mean, he's still, you know, the man of mystery and, you know, kind of the superhero. But, you know, but he gets groped in an elevator. I mean, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. Ranger getting groped in an elevator.
I absolutely loved Ranger in this. And he felt a little more relaxed. And also, last time we spoke, we had a little fantasy about Ranger in a tux. And, oh, it's so exciting that you got him into a tuxedo.
Yeah. Is that not the most wonderful visual image, Ranger in a tuxedo?
Well, not just a tuxedo. Before he wore that, you have him in another more formal outfit, not as formal as a tuxedo. And I just thought, oh, yes, I'm telling you, that image has stayed with me.
He's hot.
He's very hot. The woman who gropes him in the elevator is a fantastic character, Brenda, kind of country girl from singer from Kentucky. I absolutely adore her.
Yeah, and we all know Brenda, don't we? Brenda is, you know, she's struggling there to keep her career going and reinventing herself.
And what was your inspiration for Brenda?
There actually were a couple people. One of them was the television show with Charlie Sheen, Two and a Half Men.
Yes.
I love the mother on that show. She's in the show, she's a real estate agent. And my character is a singer. But I just love that character. You know, I think she's so great. She's like just out there. And I wanted to get some of that attitude into this character. And then, you know, there are all these singers who are aging but still very vital that go around and put on fabulous concerts every now and then. You know, and actually have a little bit more talent and are, you know, maybe more current than my character. But, you know, I was thinking of people like, you know, Cher and Dolly Parton and, you know, women who are getting to be of certain age, but, you know, certainly don't look it and don't act it.
Absolutely. And she loves her toy boys and Ranger. I also liked her stalker, Gary. And it was really nice to have a couple of characters from Kentucky in this New Jersey setup. It was really fun.
The characters that all of a sudden appear in this book, Fearless 14, they were all a little different from what I've done in the past. Usually, I have a lot of side stories in the numbered books, but they all have to do with Stephanie being an apprehension agent. And in this book, they really had more to do with the second story going, which was, you know, Brenda, you know, the singer on tour, and her stalker, and her struggle to get, you know, like this second career going, and her relationship with Stephanie and all the people around Stephanie.
I love that you keep bringing characters back, because I keep my cast list Janet from every book so that I never forget.
Yeah, and, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but that is fun, you know, that on the audio, you get to have a Kentucky accent.
For me, it's great. I mean, I just love the storytelling, and I have to say that I've always maintained this. I think you have a real gift for dialogue. It's the kind of dialogue that is very easy to read out loud. And I know this is because I think you did an acting course, you told me at one point.
I did. I had a friend who was giving acting classes, and I did some acting improv. And it was hugely helpful in being able to write dialogue.
The really exciting thing for me, and the part of the book that I am enjoying the most, is Lula's upcoming nuptials.
Yes.
Janet, there was something so heartfelt in the writing.
Yeah, well, and you know why. we're talking, of course, because my daughter Alex was married November 1st. It wasn't exactly like Alex's wedding, you know, but the bride's magazines and the agonizing, you know, over the little characters on the top, of course.
You could tell this was real author experience of the bridezilla stuff, the kind of hysteria about every little detail. And Lula planning a wedding is amazing, I have to say.
Isn't that the funniest idea? I know, I dumped it all on Lula. I just, you know, just dumped it all on Lula. But the idea of Lula planning a wedding is so outrageous anyway.
And I have to say, it's left open-ended.
Yes, it is, because to be continued.
I can't wait. So that engagement has really left us hanging, so I really hope we hear more about that in the next book.
Remember, I had a cliffhanger a while ago, where somebody showed up at Stephanie's door and told her to take her dress off, and I didn't tell anybody who it was. And I heard about that for an entire year. So now, you know, I have this other cliffhanger, and so I would just like to say that I would have ended it, but I ran out of pages in the book.
I could listen to Lula or read about Lula planning her wedding for ages, because it's so much fun. She's not the only one, though. I have to say, reading it, I'm getting a sense that some people are wanting to settle down. We see quite a lot of Stephanie's maternal side in this book.
Yeah, you do. And I think, you know, Stephanie might want to settle down. She just can't decide with whom.
I also wonder, with this wedding fever in the air, did Morelli actually propose to Stephanie? He sort of does. He seems to.
He does seem to, on the surface, although he did panic when she brought it up. Well, you know, he's proposed to her before in other books. And he might have proposed to her a couple times between books, but we don't really know about that. And, you know, but when he wants to get married, she can never quite make up her mind. And then when she wants to get married, you know, he's not sure. So I think Stephanie just, you know, moves along in her life. You know, her character progresses a little bit with each book. And I think becomes, you know, a fuller, rounder character. I think she's much more evolved than she was in the first couple books, which I think makes her a much more interesting character. I think Stephanie actually gets a little bit more interesting all the time.
I think she does. I recently reread number one, and it was wonderful. I'd forgotten how wonderful it was, but you're right. The characters have developed so much, and it's interesting to look back now from this vantage point back to one and to see the development. And she is very interesting, and I feel I know her much better.
Yeah, you know, in the beginning of the series, people would say to me, "Oh, I just love Stephanie," and I used to think to myself, "Why?" You know, because Stephanie was, you know, she was like Seinfeld. She was kind of the pivot point. She was this character that everything revolved around. But in terms of her own personality, she really was kind of vanilla. You know, she wasn't eccentric in hardly any way. She was normal to the point of being, you know, almost uninteresting sometimes. You know, at least to me, I liked a lot of the other characters I thought were more fun to write about. But I don't necessarily feel like that about her. I think she's coming into her own.
I think she is, too. And we saw, besides our usuals, we saw our old favorites, you know, Grandma and Mom and Dad and all that. And there was still stuff around the family table, which I'm happy about. And I was glad to see Mooner back.
Yeah, Mooner, we had a lot of requests for Mooner to come back. And he just seemed to fit into the story. You know, I have a lot of these secondary characters, and people would like to see them continue. I can't have all of them continue in every book, or we would just have, you know, too many characters. We'd just be flooded with them. So I have to kind of wait for an opportunity when it seems like it's absolutely appropriate for that character. You know, like in the last Between the Numbers book, I was able to bring Randy Briggs back.
I love Randy Briggs.
Yeah, but you know, because he was what that book needed. And in this book, it needs Mooner and the potato guy.
It's been great talking to you.
Okay, thank you.
And I am so looking forward to 15.
I'm going to start it as soon as I get off the phone.
This is Lorelei King. We hope you've enjoyed Fearless 14, a Macmillan audiobook from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2008 by Ivanovich Inc. Production copyright 2008 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.